Shalom and welcome again to another edition of Seekers of Meaning, the podcast arm of Jewish Sacred Aging. I'm your host, Rabbi Richard Address. We appreciate you being with us. With these podcasts, we hope to explore some of the issues that touch us, our families, and our congregation regarding the revolution in longevity that is helping to restructure our entire Jewish world. And we appreciate your support. You can follow us on our Facebook page, Jewish Sacred Aging on Facebook, our homepage, jewishsacredaging.com. If you'd like to send us a message, some comments or concerns, just address it to me, Rabbi Address at jewishsacredaging.com. And we have a very distinguished power-packed panel for today's edition of Seekers of Meaning. So let us introduce everybody. Dr. Simcha Raphael, the executive director, founder, and chief major operator of the Da'at Institute here based there in Philadelphia, Rabbi Dale Friedman, growingolder.com, and Rabbi David Levin, who heads the Jewish Relationship Institute. So shalom, welcome to all of you, and we are here to discuss about to be just publishing, we'll find out soon, book called Jewish End of Life Care in a Virtual Age, Our Traditions Reimagined. So Simcha, Dale, and David, welcome, and lots to talk about, especially in light of everything that's happening. So first of all, let me go to David. The back end of this book is as powerful as the essays are. Equally as powerful, I think, are the selection of creative rituals, prayers, liturgy that embrace the spiritual aspect of a lot of the pandemic. David, what's going on? There is so much creativity now popping up in the Jewish community around liturgy, poetry, meditation. A lot of it's being developed as a result of the pandemic. What's being tapped into the soul of our community to give light to this? What's going on?
I believe, Richard, first of all, thank you for having us. We're very excited about the book. Liturgy and prayer and rituals are all about connection. I mean, that's at the heart of why we have these things. They're manifestations of us trying to connect mind and body and soul and community. And we've had creativity all along, even though we do have a lot of fixed liturgy in our history. But this is upended. The pandemic has upended what we're used to. So the stuff that we've been doing, particularly the capacity to be physically together, doesn't exist in the moment. And it's allowed us to really become interested and focused on what are the values that our liturgy and our prayer and our ritual are trying to connect us to. What's at the essence of the wisdom tradition? And we're going deep. We're in a moment where we're intensely feeling something thrust upon us, but these are also people who are very aware of our tradition, are the scholars who have contributed to this volume, and they're able to navigate and reflect and be in the moment and pull from the tradition as well as pull from the personal experience. And I'd look directly at what Reb Simcha did as a piece of poetry/liturgy. You'd think about the prayer that we normally use when somebody has traversed illness, but Simcha, having experienced illness, came up with an intensely personal representation, going really to the heart of himself, as well as what that prayer is trying to convey. And that's the unique moment that we're in right now. It's not theoretical, it's not hypothetical. We are in the process of creating this, some people might say, building the airplane as we're flying. But we're doing it with incredibly skilled people.
No, it's just fascinating because we do a lot of work with new rituals in Jewish Sacred Aging. We just had Alden Salovey on 2 weeks ago for his new book, This Precious Life. And he was talking about some of the same phenomenon that's working in his personal life, being isolated and in Jerusalem. So and I would urge people as they get a hold of this book to pay attention not only to the essays but really some of the liturgy that comes in the back end of the book. One of the early essays, Dale, that you write, to walk in God's ways, and you talk about this concept of chesed, and I love for you to just perhaps unpack this concept a little bit, how it relates to what you were talking about in the essay, this idea of chesed.
Thank you. It's really just a delight to be here. So we're taught that we're supposed to walk in God's ways, which seems on the face of it to be a rather impossible demand. I mean, we're flesh and blood, whatever the eternal, merciful, infinite God is, that being does not have feet, that being does not have human flaws. And yet the Torah audaciously tells us to walk in God's ways. And the rabbis say that the way that we do this is to emulate God's chesed, God's loving kindness. As God comforts the mourner, so shall you the mourner. As God visits the sick, so shall you visit the sick. So in our extending beyond our finite selves, in acts of caring and connection, we are walking in God's ways. We are manifesting the divine in this world. And in this time of isolation and fear and loss and trauma, it's more important than ever that we figure out what is the technology, if you will, by which we can walk in God's ways. And that's for us as rabbis, chaplains, clergy, spiritual caregivers, volunteers, healthcare professionals, and also for family members. How do we extend our hand? A famous passage in the Talmud says that the person who comes to visit this person who's sick says, "Give me your hand." Well, how do I say, "Give me your hand," when you're on a screen opposite me and not 2 feet away? Give me your hand. What does it even mean to extend caring? And that's really a significant piece of what this book and some of the contributors have grappled with.
So Simcha, you talk about in one of your pieces that we're being called to authenticity, and you write about the cyber synagogue. Rabbi Simcha Weintraub writes about Siberia, C-Y-B-E-R-I-A, which I thought was really cool. Talk to me about what you mean in this cyber synagogue world, and if you could also just give us a little bit of an insight as to what the motivating factors were that was the genesis of this book, and then talk to me a little bit about this challenge that you're talking about, the cyber synagogue and the being called to authenticity.
So like David and Dale, I want to thank you for your graciousness to invite us here. And I want to say something about cyber synagogue. Next week is my mother's yahrzeit. So a year ago, I was thinking, do I want to go to that congregation? This congregation starts at that time. They have a nice chazanit who plays the guitar. I know people here. So it's always been a geographical decision. For next week, I have to figure out which URL I'm going to need to go to which synagogue where. And I can do it on West Coast time. I can do it on Israel time. There are some communities in Israel. So these days, particularly with regard to Yisker services and Seng Kaddish, it's not happening in the synagogue. It's happening in the cyber synagogue. And a lot of our rabbi colleagues are really working very hard to figure out how you make services and how you make resources of community available to people when basically it's looking at Hollywood squares on a screen. So One thing that's going on with regard to the end of life care rituals is that they are migrating from the congregational setting, the deathbed setting, the community setting to in-home, at-home Judaism, somebody else spoke about. And so that was kind of the initial impetus for this book. Right after Pesach, I called one of my friends. I said, "How are you doing?" She said, "I'm so tired. I just did a Zoom funeral. I just did a Zoom Yisker service." She said, "We need a virtual rabbi's manual." So I have been writing in this area, and Dale has been working in this area. Dave and I have been collaborating. So I invited both of them to think with me on how we can create not just a virtual rabbi's manual, but for caregivers, mental health professionals, for clergy. What do you need to know about some of these issues that we're dealing with, from the A to the Z, or from the Vidui to Yisker of the Jewish end of life traditions? And so we put together 15 essays and I guess about 8-9 pieces of supplemental liturgy in the appendix. And it just came into being. It kept us busy during the time of social distancing. We never met together face to face in 6 months of working on this book, other than on the computer.
So, well, yeah, the whole cyber, we just about, which is January, so end of November, beginning of December, we had one of the podcasts had a couple of our colleagues and actually our producer, Steve, who was the tech advisor to his synagogue, really talking about what this transition into a virtual cyber synagogue meant during the holidays, but more importantly, what the implication is going forward. And I do a lot of work, as you know, with synagogues. And basically, this is the way of the future. And any congregation that thinks that they're going to go back to the way it was in January of 2020 and think that's the way it's going to be will probably be out of business within 5 years. But so you talk about simply the migration, I think that's the word you use, of end of life rituals into a different framework. And there's this fascinating essay in the book of the Tahara Ruchanit. The Tahara Ruchanit. Walk me through, one of you, what this is and the trend and that migration from the Chevra Kedisha room, let's say at the funeral home, to the screen.
Well, let me start and we'll see if either of my colleagues want to add. Pastoral care you could minister face to face, or you could still be present for people through a screen. Washing and purifying a dead body and dressing it and preparing it for burial, I think that's a little trickier in some ways. So Richard Light, whom you know and who's been doing work with Tahara for a long time, has created this kind of spiritual Tahara. It may be that something might be going on in the funeral home or not, but it tries to get to the rituals that are done with a community of 4 to 6 people will often do a Tahara, and they will do certain kind of prayers and certain kind of ritual washing and dressing of the body of the deceased. So that's all being done in a kind of meditative, sort of interactive way through the computer. So if I'm not able to be present washing the body, but we're each sitting with some kind of water so that we're doing a symbolic enactment of the pouring of the water, that's one way of doing it. The other piece that is in the Tahara Ruchanit are meditative processes. The garments that are used for dressing the body of the deceased are said to be representative of the clothes that the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, wore. And so Richard Light has developed these very appropriate meditations that the group will do as a whole of visualizing that, all the way to visualizing placing the body of the deceased in a casket. And I haven't tried it, and I'm still alive, so nobody's done that for me yet. But it's adapting to the needs of the moment. And the needs of the moment are, if we can't be present with a physical body, how are we going to do this in a way that gives holiness and a sense of sacred to this process? And I think he's done a fantastic job of that.
I'd love to kind of zoom out from that for a moment, if I could, just to say that I think what happened to Richard Light's Chevra Kadisha was they hit a wall. They had members of the community die, and it was not safe for them to come into contact with the bodies because of contagion from coronavirus. So suddenly, the means that they had to deal with this loss and to mark in a spiritual and holy way were unavailable. And I think that happened in every realm that our book deals with. It happened in terms of pastoral care. No, you know, you cannot be in the room with the family member and the person who's very, very ill. No, you cannot facilitate Jewish life in person for the elders who are living in a Jewish communal setting. No, you cannot have Shiva and gather and feed the mourners. And in each case, what happened in hitting that brick wall was remarkable ingenuity. And as David said earlier, I think getting to what is the heart of this? What's the heart of Shiva? Well, it's not, as Ann Brenner says in her chapter, just the bagels and the hugs that we all miss so much, particularly the hugs, but it's being present, listening, witnessing grief, sharing stories, and it turns out we can find other ways of doing that. And I think just as this Ruchanit, the spirit, the Tahara Ruchanit does that with the rituals of preparing a body for burial, that's really what our authors are sharing in each domain, is how can we develop new tools in our toolbox to accomplish the, as we say in Hebrew, etzem ha'inyan, the heart of the matter of accompanying those who are dying, their family members, their community.
Well, but what these essays do, and both of you are pointing this out, is it's really, if you take a step back and you take a look at the material in the book, it's an insight into the adaptive process of the Jewish tradition. And, you know, historically, and we've all taught this lesson in to groups, that the secret, as my teacher, Dr. Rifkin of blessed memory, ingrained into us at the seminary, is that one of the reasons we've been able to survive is because Judaism had the unique ability to adapt to new circumstances and create new ways of adapting tradition to these new circumstances. And in truth, the book, Jewish End of Life Care in a Virtual Age, Our Traditions, and you use it, reimagined, is exactly a textbook in many ways. As I read this and read through it, that adaptive process was really that's at the heart in many ways of what this book is really about. So in addition, as a teaching tool for colleagues, chaplains, etc., I think that's one of the messages that at least came to me and resonates within the tradition. You have a whole series you have a couple of essays that deal with some of the intense bioethics challenges that are presented in this day and age. You have this sort of like literary dialogue between Rabbi Jason Wiener and Rabbi Dr. David Teutsch, from two different perspectives of how to approach end of life issues. I'll just throw this up from the old College Bowl days. You may not be old enough to remember that show, but for us old people, we do remember that show as a toss up. Walk me through some of the dialogue and the differences and how Rabbi Wiener, Dr. Teutsch approached these very, very significant challenges, especially in light of the end, the medical aid in dying legislation, which is in California, it's here in New Jersey, and 10 jurisdictions, as well as Canada. Who wants to take that? But somebody.
Dale's our bioethicist in house.
I'll start. So I think if you were to go to Rabbi Dr. David Teutsch or Rabbi Dr. Jason Weiner and ask them a she'elah, a question seeking a rabbinic opinion about can a respirator, for example, be used on one person rather than another in the event that there are scarce medical resources and there aren't enough to go around? Or can somebody who is obviously inexorably dying somehow be relieved of medical treatment in order to die? I think that both of them would very likely come to the same place, but from totally different perspectives. Rabbi Dr. Jason Weiner, I'm not sure if he says Weiner or Weiner, I'm sorry to say. But anyway, he's an Orthodox rabbi, and he is a chaplain. So he brings the richness of being immersed in halachic discourse and contemporary Jewish legal discourse and his clinical experience in the hospital to say, we do need to address how are we going to allocate scarce resources? And there are within Jewish tradition some guidelines for it. And there are also things we cannot do. He says we can't do anything that comes anywhere close to actively causing a death. But we could passively, perhaps, not renew a treatment. Or we could do things that would allow an inevitable death to come. On the other hand, Rabbi David Teutsch comes from a Reconstructionist perspective, and he uses an approach called values-based decision-making, which is very high on process. How do you go about analyzing situation? How do you make sure the right people are in the room? How do you make sure that the focus is on the wishes and the values of the key person, namely the patient? And he articulates some core Jewish values like the preciousness of life, but also like community, and we have to figure out how to share resources. So they have different methodologies and different frames of reference, and yet they both bring, I think, a great deal of compassion and wisdom to the very wrenching decisions. One of the things that I've discovered in talking to colleagues who are on the front lines in chaplaincy is that many, 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 many conversations have to be had about what's called terminal extubation. When are we going to stop using this respirator that is clearly only prolonging the dying of this person who is suffering from COVID? And that is a very difficult conversation to have in any case, but to have that conversation knowing that there are three other patients that could be using that respirator who might have a better chance of recovery makes these questions incredibly urgent and timely.
Living that, if you believe the headlines in the news, given the surges now post-Thanksgiving, post-Christmas, travel, et cetera, et cetera, and the limited amount of we are actually living that scarce resource question all over the United States of America. David, you spend a significant amount of time in doing the mitzvah with the Red Cross and some of the work in high trauma concerns and issues. And given the pandemic and the virtualness of how we care for people, how are you beginning to deal with it? Natural disasters and disasters haven't stopped. And you're talking about virtual this, that, and the other thing. I just talk to me real fast about how you're handling that.
It's complicated. The initial response from the Red Cross is to preserve the lives of the caregiver, the person who's out there on the front line. And that idea of Pikuach Nefesh is actually a very Jewish idea. So, you know, we're looking at it from the perspective of we don't want people unduly risking themselves for the purpose of being a nurturer in time of particular need. So there's a lot of virtual work being done. But one of the things I think that we're looking at now as we negotiate this pandemic is really where do we fit in? You know, from a caregiver's point of view, I'm looking at people who are heroic on the front lines of healthcare professionals. They're extraordinary men and women who are doing amazing, amazing work. I'm putting their lives on the line. And one of the questions that I personally am grappling with is, where do I fit into that? Is the virtual sufficient? And I think that as our colleagues have been struggling and sharing these insights through our book, as well as in their other work, they're asking themselves, where is that line? There is not a definitive marker. It's a gray area. And we're all being challenged. How do we navigate this? Can we navigate this? Do we belong in that hospital room right there next to the nurse? And I think that that's a really important question for us to be talking about. And in the pandemic, assuming that the pandemic's going to be around for a while longer, and the effects, even in a post-vaccine world, will be lingering, the question is, how do we have presence? How do we find ourselves being in that space together? And I think it's on all of our rabbis' minds right now as they reconceive or reimagine what it means to be in community. As Simcha noted in his conversation regarding honoring his mother's yard site, he can go to any synagogue that he pleases. So because he's no longer constrained by the traditional geographic understanding of community, we too are now no longer constrained by a geographic understanding of community and all of our understanding. We have to rethink what it means to be in community, what it means to be either literally or figuratively present, creating a group that we call ours. And that's one of the things that I believe is, it's probably the next book that we do if we have the opportunity to collaborate, to continue the conversation. This is a beginning, not an end. And all of the insight and wisdom that we've garnered here, I think I'm deeply honored and privileged to be a part of the enterprise, but it's not the end of the enterprise. I think all of our colleagues are struggling with how do we push this thing forward and how do we continue to tap a tradition which is so deep and rich with meaning and connect it to the people that are looking and seeking that wisdom.
So let me follow up with that and throw it open to the panel. How do we deal with this virtual spiritual care? All of us who are trained to be present. But now we, in many cases, we can't be present. Long distance caregiving, when we used to be able to, before March the 15th, get on a plane and fly to so-and-so. I just was dealing with a family now that had to do all this long distance, and all of us have had this experience. How do we begin to have this sense of meaning in this virtual spiritual care world that we're dealing with? And the B part of that, because all of us have talked to colleagues who are overwhelmed, how do we maintain a sense of self-care? Because the burnout factor, I don't think has ever been higher amongst chaplains, congregational colleagues, dealing with all this from a whole variety of different levels. So that's a nice, easy softball two-part question, all right?
Well, let me go to the first part.
Okay.
Okay.
Go ahead.
So when we asked our authors to write, we said, we don't only want to know what you're doing, but we want to know the long-term potential implications and applications of this cyber synagogue, of this virtual end-of-life care. And so people are reporting, oh my God, at the funeral there were people from all around the world popping in. Oh my God, the Shiva house, after the service was over, people stayed on for another hour and chatted with each other and told stories about this person's life. So I think one of the applications and implications of this period of time is that some of this hybridity, being able to have an in-person Shiva service and have a Zoom screen, being able to do a funeral and invite people in from all around, I think that's here to stay. And I think that's going to change the way in which we're doing this stuff for the long run. And I think so while there is overwhelm and while there are problems with doing it, your question was about meaning. I think there's a certain enhancement of meaning that comes with the globalization of our Jewish experience, with, in some sense, the democratization. I tell a story in the piece that I wrote that I taught a class recently, and there was somebody from South America. They were from the West Coast, they were from the East Coast, and they were from Israel. Way back when we used to sit by the waters of Babylon and lament Israel. And today, if you have fast internet, you can stay up all night, we can bring Israel online. So that some of the meaning making is coming out of some of the positive implications of that. I'll let either of my two colleagues and co-editors address the question about self-care when we're exiled to Siberia.
Well, I want to just go back, if I could, to spiritual care at a distance. And there are just some accounts in the book from our authors that I'll never forget. For example, Rabbi Michal Springer, who's a hospital chaplain in the epicenter of COVID in New York City, writes about a wife who asks her to help support her to not listen to the doctors who say there's no hope for her husband. And she promises the wife that she will pray for this man, but she cannot go into his room and pray at his bedside. So she stands at the window of the room and she's praying. And she thinks, how could I possibly be praying at the bedside divided by a window? And she is shocked to realize that she's praying with him and that her prayers are not only having an effect on him and on his wife who's on the phone, but also on the staff members who are caring for this man who themselves feel buoyed by these prayers and who Rabbi Springer imagines are carrying those prayers with them as they go in to care for the man. So that is one just staggering example of how the capacity to accompany can happen even when there are barriers that would seem to be insuperable. And that's because spirit is not limited to a physical location. And the other story that I was thinking about was just the impact of deathbed vidui prayers, deathbed confessionals, where the family member is separated from the person who's dying and the chaplain, in this case, Chaplain Malcolm Middleman, who wrote about end-of-life care for elders dying during the pandemic, said that she is physically often present with the person when their family members can't be, and yet having a video conference or even a telephone call in which people get to say their last words and to share prayer in that incredibly infinite sacred moment of crossing over is deep and comforting and real. So I'm I guess I want to just say that I'm really heartened by what's possible at a remove. And the other side is, of course, the cost to the caregivers, which is massive. And Rabbi Simcha Weintraub's chapter on being exiled to Siberia and what can we do to care for ourselves is incredibly important. And he points out, of course, that and that it's not optional. And Rabbi Josh Lesser, who wrote about mobilizing his congregational community during the pandemic, said that he happens to be in Atlanta, so they're near the CDC, and they have all these wonderful public health professionals in the congregation. So they created a task force for COVID-19, excuse me, of healthcare professionals in the congregation, and they set some priorities. And the priorities were, number one, keep the staff and clergy healthy. Number two, keep the congregants healthy. And number three, address health in the wider community. So Rabbi Lesser writes about how that priority set by the committee was an incredible teaching for him, because he thought, who am I to be worried about my own health and well-being? And because of the way in which that priority had been articulated as a communal priority, that the caregiver, the clergy person, the spiritual caregiver must take care of herself or himself or themselves in order to be able to foster the well-being of the community. You know, we often think about self as kind of a frill, like I'll get to it when I can, but no. And Rabbi, let's talk about some of the ways that he's engaged in self-care.
His chapter talks about, there's a great image that he writes about a spiritual scaffolding, which I thought was a tremendous image when you think about it, about the scaffold allows new work to take place and also supports that which was done and allows you to transition to something else. And that's really part of the self-care too, which we really do forget about. Listen, before we run out of time, we're going to start to run out of time. I do want to raise many other issues, but something that we come across a lot, and I know all of us have come across, and I know all of our colleagues have come across. David, I'll start with you on this one, and that is, how do you think we as the community are going to be able to deal with this displaced grief? We have people who have lost people. They may not have gone to the funeral of a spouse, God forbid, a child, a parent. I know I've done funerals where the family has said, we just don't want to Zoom shiver. We're going to wait. But they carry this grief. Okay. It's this displaced grief, which I think is going to hit us overwhelmingly when all this thing changes, whatever. How do you begin to formulate a response to this? What do we do in the meantime to bridge? Because people are, we know people who are holding this grief, and they haven't had that, even a Zoom opportunity to share that story that we've all been involved with in Zoom shivers. What's the implication of this displaced grief?
Well, I think this also is a deep conversation that needs to continue, but I think it goes to the heart of connectedness. We are all, I think that what you're talking about, and Judaism has taken an opportunity to deal with grief. I think our end of life and mourning rituals are brilliant in the way they've evolved and been constructed so thoughtfully and deliberately to help usher people through, or at least help people to get through the process. So one of the things, by the way, that goes back to Rick Light's virtual Tahara idea that I found interesting, if I zoom out, puns intended, is that the Chevra Kedisha, which is doing this holy work, is a group that has found a way to tap into the mystical issues as well as the more practical issues of caring and honoring the body, the kavod aspect that we're concerned with. But there's also the nechum aspect, the comforting of the bereaved. And here's an opportunity where we can find some solace. In a lot of my work, I hear when death occurs and I'm called in, one of the emotional responses is, he's alone in there. I don't want him to be alone. Dad is alone in that cold place. It's a very interesting emotional response. And I think what's happening in the virtual Tahara is that the person who's grieving has the assurance that indeed, at least on a psychological level, on a spiritual level, on a deep emotional level, their father is not alone, that we have figured out a way to be there with them. And there's an opportunity there to seek comfort. Similarly, I think our opportunities for community are another way for us to engage the grieving process. We don't do a really good job talking about death, dealing with death in American culture, but we do an extraordinary way of handling death and comforting each other in Jewish culture. And as it hopefully, as people look towards the tradition and look towards the clergy that is blessed with knowing about the tradition, they're able to make those connections which make them feel less alone. The unveiling is another thing that pops to mind, with people being denied the opportunity to properly bury their loved one. The opportunity, hopefully, when we can get back into, at least in a physically distanced gathering, we can use the unveiling as an opportunity to amp up the experience in a way that was in some respects denied because of a virtual funeral or even a non-funeral or just one or two people attending the funeral. So there are opportunities for us to connect. I think the yard site may be another opportunity for us to connect with family and friends and do the kind of thing that we're talking about, recalling in the virtual shivas, recalling stories and sharing and making those or expanding those rituals as ways to connect with others. We don't have to do that or any of this alone. And what our colleagues have demonstrated is that there's this incredible creativity going on to help people overcome that sense of aloneness.
So on that note, which is a good note to end on, this idea of creativity and embracing what may be in the future, I want to thank all of you for your contributions and the time and friendship. Most of all, I'll be honest with you, just friendship and the ability to work with you. Again, the book, now available, or very soon available, Jewish End-of-Life Care in a Virtual Age, Our Traditions Reimagined. You know something real fast before we end? Is this going to be in print or just online?
Publisher is Albion Andalus, and they will do a print version, and they'll also do an ebook.
To all of you, to Dr. Simcha Raphael from the Da'at Institute, Rabbi Dale Friedman from growingolder.net, and Rabbi David Levin from the Jewish Relationships Institute. Ladies, thank you very, very much. Really, Dale, Simcha, David, continued success, continued joy, but most of all, just stay healthy, stay safe. Thank you very much. Good luck with the book. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
To all of you, I want to thank you again for being a part of today's edition of The Seekers of Meaning, the TV show and podcast arm of Jewish Sacred Aging. Remember, we're now available on the Roku network. If you don't know what that is, get a grandchild or a 10-year-old. They'll hook it up for you without any problem. And again, we welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email them to me, rabbiaddress@jewishsacredaging.com. We invite you again to visit our Facebook page, Jewish Sacred Aging on Facebook. And if you'd like to make a tax-free donation to allow us to help continue our work, You can go to the website, jewishsacredaging.com, and click on the conveniently located donate button. Seekers of Meaning is produced at the Broadcast Center of Lubetkin Media Companies in beautiful Cherry Hill, New Jersey. And a big shout out and todah rabah to our producer, Steve Lubetkin. Thank you for joining us. I'm your host, Rabbi Richard Address, and I look forward to greeting you on our next edition of Seekers of Meaning, the TV show and podcast arm of Jewish Sacred Aging. Todah, l'hitra'ot, stay safe, stay healthy, everybody.